Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, everybody. I am excited to welcome you back. I hope that you're really enjoying the Tutor Summit so far. I hope you're really learning a lot. The next speaker is James Bolton, and he has a podcast called the Queens of England Podcast. And I first found him almost 2 years ago now, and he was still pretty new. And I thought, I want to do something with him. And so I wrote to him. And since that time, he did a guest episode on my show about Henry VIII's mistresses. And then we did an episode together on Catherine of Aragon. And so I'm really excited that he's taking part in this. So I have to tell you, my little caveat about the videos. When I recorded this, I don't know what was going on with my internet. I live in rural Spain, right? It's like every time it rains, the internet goes out. I don't understand it, but it's how it is. And so our internet like was just not working. So I actually turned off my video. And so it's just him. And so I've added the questions and you'll see. But anyway, that's my caveat on the video. Like I said before, it's a learning experience, right? It's a learning experience. So hope you're having fun. James is amazing. And let me introduce you to James and the Queens of England. So too often when we think about the history of a country, we think about the kings and the lords, the castles and battles. Even when we consider rulers, we think about people like Elizabeth I and Victoria when we think of queens. But what about the queens who sat beside their husband, the queen's consort? The generations of women who held no formal power, but still wove an important strand in the tapestry of England. The Queens of England is an alternative history of England told through the lives of the women behind the throne. So I'm so excited now to bring in James Bolton and hear his story, his history, his quick tour of the wives of Henry VIII. Here we go. So the first question is to walk us through the story of the six wives, but from a different perspective, because we all know the story of divorce, beheaded, died, divorce, beheaded, survived, but what's something different and unique about each wife that we might not already
see, know? As we all know, Henry VIII had six wives. Not all of them reigned equally. Catherine of Aragon actually reigned for longer than all the rest of them combined, so it's kind of difficult to compare them completely. And obviously I knew some of them, better when I started than when I finished. I just finished covering them all. For Catherine of Aragon, I kind of knew quite a lot about her because I've studied that period of history a lot more extensively than perhaps, the later wives. But often I think when you study Catherine of Aragon, you don't think about, the bit before she became queen. The bit when she was married to Arthur, everyone knows, of course, that she was married to Henry's older brother before he died. But I loved, because I'm a tremendous nerd, finding out about sort of all the negotiations, because we had Arthur, Henry's father, Henry VII, and Catherine's father, Ferdinand, were tremendous negotiators, but also incredibly obstinate men who were incredibly tight and never wanted to spend any money. And so we have this sort of incredibly long series of negotiations trying to arrange this marriage, really leaving Catherine in a horrible state of limbo, going to England and being sort of stuck there And I think that was a very strong formative experience for her. She still had to learn to rely on herself, to not trust anyone. And I think that was very instructive for me when thinking about her, particularly in her later years. For Anne Boleyn, for me, it's not so much a unique thing, because obviously many of Henry VIII's wives suffered a fall. But for me, what I found was really fascinating was the long, slow burn that was the way that she came to the throne. It took 7 years. And from their first meeting, through the courtship, through trying to get the divorce, through eventually getting married, getting on the throne. And then she lost it in the space of just a few days, from when Cromwell / Henry, depending on your view and who you blame, first moved, to when she was imprisoned. Then it took less than 3 weeks for her to lose her head. It's a truly fascinating period. For Jane Seymour, I discovered a new word when I was studying her, something called good estate. And that's that she was the first Queen of England in a while, or maybe not the first, but one of the very few for a very long time in English history who died in what's called good estate, which is she was in favour at the time of her death. She was, of course, died giving birth to Edward VI, the long and sought for heir to the throne. But if you look at previous queens of England, with the exception of Elizabeth of York and perhaps Anne Neville, although obviously Henry III wasn't all that popular, loads of queens before them had died with either the people, the king, or the nobility hating their guts. And so Jane is this rare person that everyone seemed to like when she died, because she provided the long sought for heir that everyone knows about. For Anne of Cleves, everyone of course knows about the fact that she's the ugly one, even though she wasn't, and she was the one that, you know, Henry married even though he didn't really want to, and then got quickly. But what I found is really quite sweet about Anne of Cleves is that when she was having this long journey sent off to England, she, you know, came from Germany, the Low Countries, this long journey through to Calais, and then had to wait there for a long time because of storms, and then coming over to England. Of what things that she asked some of the English delegations there about, she wanted to find out more about Henry, and more importantly, she wanted to find out what made him tick, and what she had to do to impress him and to try and make this work. She tried to learn a bit more about the sorts of things that he liked his wives to do. And so you so often see these women in history as being very passive actors. And yet Anne here was sort of taking it upon herself to try and really make this whole thing work. And of course, sadly, it didn't. For Catherine Howard, I love Catherine Howard, even though she was a terrible queen, she's possible not to like. I've enjoyed finding out about this weird house that she essentially grew up in. She, her father was a complete waste of space. Her mother died young. And so she was essentially taken into the care of an elderly relative who had in her care a load of young women. And she took absolutely no interest in making sure that lots of men weren't getting in and enjoying and partying and all sorts of things in this sort of, I think I described it in my episode, sort of boarding school come sex den. And it's just reading some of the things, you find out that they had a secret hiding place in their dormitory where they used to hide the men. And you have these sort of weird sort of slapstick moments where someone tells the Duchess that there's men and she comes storming in, but they hide behind this thing. I think it was a tapestry or trapdoor. It was something weird like that. And then with Catherine Parr, again, a lot of people know that she was the many widowed queen. She had four husbands in all, three of them predeceased her. She died shortly after marrying Thomas Seymour. And what I find is you don't hear a lot about the first two husbands. They're seen as a sort of an important prologue. But they're all so very different from each other. You have the first husband is this sort of young, quivering wreck, dominant, you know, under the sort of the, I can't think of the word like this. He had this incredibly strong, dominant father figure who sounds a bit terrifying. And then you have, he's really just looking for someone to mother his children for him. And she takes on this very stepmotherly role. And then, of course, you have the third husband, Henry, where she's a queen. She's in the sort of forefront of the reform of the church and of Protestantism, all that sort of agent. She's got all this stuff going on, completely different from the quite provincial life that she had in her first two marriages. And then with the fourth husband, or you have, you know, the three other matches were all for advance, not a lot of option, really. They were chosen for her or sent to her by circumstances. And then she chose this fourth choice was very much for love, but, you know, she was actually treated well by her three other husbands, and her fourth husband, who she married for love, treated her very badly. Thomas Seymour is not a very nice man. Mm. So yeah, that's my things I learned from studying the six wives.
So I've heard before Catherine of Aragon was described as the last medieval queen. And I'm curious whether you would agree with that, and if so, how? And if not, why? So maybe talk a little bit about this idea of what medieval queenship was and how that changed, not just with Anne Boleyn, because obviously that was very different, but even with later queens like Jane Seymour. So I'm interested in that.
Well, the problem when trying to say that Catherine of Aragon is the last medieval queen is you have to then spend about 5 minutes describing what a medieval queen is before you can say whether she was the last of them. I'll give you a boring introduction to this, which is, of course, let's remember the Middle Ages is an artificial construct created by history up. The medieval period in an English sense is really sort of seen as from about when the Romans left to sort of Henry VIII, Tudors-y era, sort of, you know, late sort of 5th century BCE to, 5th century CE to about 1500, 16th century CE. So you can sort of see Catherine, you know, she's right on that dividing line, then maybe she was. Mm. But that's somewhat problematic because she's obviously far more similar to fellow queens, sort of to Anne Boleyn, the rest of the wives going into the Stuart queens, than she is to the wives of Alfred the Great, of even William the Conqueror. I mean, going back to the sort of Saxon kings and queens. But that's not really what you're looking for. So let's let's sort of dig a little bit deeper. And I guess what's a more interesting question is she more similar to the queens that came before her? So we're looking at people like Elizabeth Woodville, Margaret of Anjou, going back to France, Anne of Bohemia, the Wars of the Roses era, and before that, because obviously the Wars of the Roses is a slightly tumultuous time. Or is she more similar to people like Anne Boleyn, people like Jane Seymour, going through to Anne of Denmark, Henrietta Maria, or the Stuarts? And I would say, in that sense, yes, she probably is the last medieval queen. But because she seems to imbue a lot of what I would call the classic medieval attributes, she isn't the last Catholic queen of England, because Jane Seymour was definitely a Catholic, Anne of Cleves was definitely a Catholic. Catherine Howard wasn't really religious as far as I can tell, but she was at least culturally Roman Catholic. Anne Boleyn, she wasn't Protestant. She was very much a reforming person. So whether you want to call her like a reformist Catholic or something else, say, but Catherine of Aragon isn't Catholic, but she lived in the last time when England was under the auspices, under papal authority. And so you see her doing things like giving lots of money to monasteries and that kind of infrastructure, which just didn't exist after of the 1540s. she wasn't the last arranged foreign marriage either. And that's obviously something that is often very much associated with the Middle Ages. But I mean, that carried on right through to the 18th, arguably 20th century even. So you can't really say that. She wasn't the last regent either. Sometimes medieval queenship, you know, these women who were often in situations would become the kingdom when the husband was away, because medieval kingship was very much this sort of family kinship group ruling. Medieval monarchs weren't absolute monarchs like you get in the modern period. They tended to rule by consent, by domination of the nobility, but always with powerful warlord rather than something higher, really. And so that's why you can get queens ruling more in the Middle Ages, but we do get it afterwards. Catherine Parr did it. Mm-hmm. But you don't see all of ever again. She's like this complete medieval queen. She has conventional piety. The problem I've often had when the other wives of Henry VIII is, what is conventional piety in a post-break with Rome England? What does it look like? It looks completely different to what a medieval queen being conventionally pious was. You know, you sort of think about, you know, did they give lots of money to the church? Did they patronize monastery? Did they give alms to the poor? Did they look at things like local centers of learning? Catherine of Aragon did all of that, and that's a huge part of what queenship was. And yet, you can't do that in a post-Catholic dominated country. Mm. Final thing is, everyone knows Anne Boleyn was executed, and she was the first English queen, certainly since the Conquest, maybe ever. The Anglo-Saxon days are kind of dark. Every queen after Anne Boleyn, particularly in the set of Henry VIII, lived under this spectre of, there is a possibility that if things go wrong, if I don't do my job, if I don't show due deference, if I don't stay on Henry's good books, I could lose my life. That spectre had never been there before. You know, queens had got into dread with their husbands. I mean, Eleanor of Aquitaine is always the outlier throughout all of medieval queens, because she is a ruler in her own right. She's incredibly powerful. She rebelled against her husband and she was just imprisoned. We have Elizabeth Woodville, who was imprisoned after her brother-in-law took the throne. You have other queens who rebel, and yet they're still kept alive, because killing a queen, killing a woman, was seen as something you didn't do. It was unchivalric. It was not the done thing. And yet Anne Boleyn was executed, and everyone else had to live under spectre. And Catherine of Aragon didn't have that. So, in summary, it's somewhat difficult to call the last medieval queen definitively, because the question is fraught with definitional problems. But yes, I would say she is the last medieval queen.
So one of the kind of stereotypes of Catherine of Aragon is that what we know of her is just based around her fertility. Like, it's her inability to have a son. There's so much more to her than that. She was such an intelligent woman. I'm curious, what else is there? What do you think of when you think of Catherine of Aragon? What else should we be thinking of when we think of her?
Yeah, it's so frustrating when you study these queens, and everyone loves to take their own agency away. You sort of see them as these sort of people who had things done to them. And it's understandable, because they didn't have a huge amount of power. A lot of the power that they did have was at the behest of the husband, and a lot of things that did happen to them, they didn't have a huge amount of control over. But looking at Catherine of Aragon, she's possibly the best example of that, because I describe her as pretty much the perfect queen, certainly perfect queen in a medieval sense. You know, she was she came from a good family. She gave brought a good dowry. She brought a foreign alliance. She was a great moral example. She was very popular. And yet the one thing that she had to do, admittedly the most important thing she had to do, she has no control over. It's not like, it wasn't for lack of trying. She wasn't one of those queens that, because of their religiousness, thought that sex with it, having sex with your husband to try and procreate was a bit, She had many, many pregnancies and many, many, must have been traumatic miscarriages, and she kept going.
And she had very late.
It wasn't for lack of trying.
Like, it was, she carried to term several times and still lost the child. It wasn't just early. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, go on.
Yes. But for me, what I like to think of her, Catherine Vagan, for me, is incredibly frustrating because she was incredibly, I called her the obstinate. Well, I actually quoted someone else calling her obstinate. She was incredibly obstinate to the point where she actually made things a lot harder for herself. But she's incredibly tenacious and she didn't change her mind. She never gave in. She was incredibly courageous for standing up for herself, for standing up for her daughter, Mary. And I like to think of her in that sense, particularly as it's a more interesting way of looking at her, because we'll go on to talk about Anne of Cleves, but she did the completely different thing to what Anne of Cleves did when she was Henry wants to divorce. You know, Anne of Cleves essentially gave her what she wanted, what Henry wanted. She took the deal. Catherine didn't. She fought him every step of the way. And what's brilliant when studying him is she beat him every single time. Every time he sent nobles over, she just wiped the floor with her. She came in and again absolutely won the show, but every time she won, she lost, because every time she did that, she had a little bit more of her dowry, a little bit more of privilege, a little bit more money, a little more household taken away. It's not always good to stand up to the king. But I prefer to think of her in that sense, as someone who took decisions, who did things. Mm-hmm. I also like to think of her as a stateswoman. I talk a lot about how she was a regent when Henry went off to war in France. She was in control in England, had to deal with this enormous Scottish invasion that happened in 1513. She sort of supervised the organization of the army that went off to fight James IV of Scots at Flodden. She was an advisor to Henry, because in the early part of Henry's reign, he didn't have this all-powerful chief minister figure that he then ended up having with Wolsey and with Cromwell. She did all of that, but she was this experienced person. She had great contacts because of her family. She could do things. Like I said, she's the perfect queen. She does everything except for that all important child, but it wasn't her fault. So I don't think it's particularly fair when thinking about her with modern eyes to focus too much on that. Although, of course, when we look at it through the eyes of the people there, that was the most important thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then a similar question for Anne. People remember her in so many different ways, call her a feminist, and she's remembered for bringing the Reformation, and then obviously her downfall. What do you think of? What do you remember her for?
Anne Boleyn is incredibly popular. I did a poll at the end of when I stopped covering, well, I finished covering the Tudor Queens. I've just finished it. And she won with 48% of the vote, and no one else even came close. So she's very well remembered by a lot of people for a lot of reasons. I don't like using modern concepts, modern ideas when talking about or thinking about people from Middle Ages. It's incredibly problematic, and you start thinking, you leave the minds of the person at the time, you start trying to put a 20th century, 21st century person in there. So I don't like using the word feminist.
Sure.
But she is this incredibly strong-willed woman, and she wanted to try and redefine the notion of what a queen was at the time. She wasn't really content with being a consort. She didn't want to be a ruling queen as such. She didn't have those kind of pretensions. She wasn't stupid. Mm-hmm. But she saw herself as this equal to Henry, maybe not in terms of power and prestige. You know, she didn't, you know, she, like I said, she didn't want to rule, but she thought that her voice should matter as much as anyone else's at court, more so than any of his advisors, and that she sort of, to use a modern phrase, you know, thought she should tell the truth to power and call Henry out, and you know, she found out to her cost that you can't do that. It's very different when you're the mistress and you're chasing something that you don't have. It's very different when you have that. Mm-hmm. I like to think of her also as she was quite a low-born woman. You know, she wasn't from a great family. Her father was the ambassador to France, mainly because he got himself a very advantageous marriage to a Howard. But sort of a self-made woman in the sense of she went to the continent very young, to the courts of Margaret of Austria and then in France as well. And she made connections, she impressed people. She carried herself with an incredible sense of decorum. She picked things up, she was like a sponge. She picked up all these continental fashions, which, you know, the continental Europe in terms of culture was always a few years, a few decades ahead of England. And so she sort of was at the apex of what a modern woman was. And so she mobilized all of these things because she wasn't a particularly, from what we can understand from the time, a particularly attractive woman. Most people sort of describe her as being of moderate looks, which is something you wouldn't say nowadays, but it's what they said at the time. But she had an incredible charm, vivacity, forcefulness, intelligence. And, you know, that's what, I'm not surprised why people love her now, because that's the sort of the modern feminist ideal. Someone who didn't get there because of, you know, wealth or power or who her father was, or even, you know, just because of her looks, but because of her intelligence, the way that she carried herself. I also like to think of her in terms, again, like Catherine of Aragon, in terms of her bravery and courage. I don't want to, you know, demean her by saying, oh, wasn't she brave? But she was incredibly courageous in how she dealt with her fall. Mm. You know, like Catherine of Aragon, she was incredibly good at her trial. She, again, apparently wiped the floor. Even Lucy Chapuis, who said that she was brilliant in that court, and everyone felt rather uncomfortable because, of course, it wasn't a fair trial. She was going to be found guilty. Mm-hmm. But if there was any fairness at all in the proceedings, she would have been acquitted because the evidence against her was completely laughable. She was interested in religious reform, in music and learning. She has this incredibly wide range of interests. But I think for me, what I find most fascinating about her is the way she managed to manipulate Henry. How she managed, you know, not just when she was on the chase, but when she was queen. Like I said, she felt, lots of people sort of think that as soon as she gave birth to Elizabeth, that was it. You know, as soon as it became clear she wasn't going to give a son, she was done. Her fall was incredibly quick. She went from pretty decent position to dead in no time at all. It's because she managed to, even though she couldn't give him the son as quickly as everyone wanted, she managed to make herself very useful in a stable around her. Lots of powerful people. There was a big Boleyn party. And she used get things done to move things along the way she wanted to, get the people appointed she wanted to. Mm. She was incredibly gifted as a politician.
So how do you think that Jane Seymour would have ruled if she had lived? What kind of differences do you think we would have seen with her? What kind of queen would she have been?
It's very difficult because we know little about her it was really difficult doing the research on her because she emerged from like Anne Boleyn. In some ways they're quite similar, in some ways they're villain, but they both came from similarly quite provincial families, not great families. Now we think of the Seymours as being powerful, but that only happened because of Jane becoming the queen and then raising the rest of her family. But we don't really have a good idea of what Jane's personality was because we don't see much of it. With that said, we can see through lots of other, the queen gives birth to a son. Everything, their position, their prestige always increases because of queenship at the time, is to bring on the next generation. And particularly with Henry, particularly with the precarious nature of the Tudor family, that it wasn't clear who would take over if Henry didn't provide a stable heir. So I think we can make an educated guess that Jane would have become a more powerful figure. She wasn't crowned. She was the first of Henry's wives not to receive a coronation. None of the rest of them did. She might well have gotten a coronation, who knows. There you can see there's a lot of Seymours congregating around her. We have her two brothers, Edward and Thomas, and there are other Seymours as well who could have been raised, so you could have seen a faction developing, like you got with the Boleyn faction, like you got with the Woodvilles, mm-hmm. With Edward IV. So she could have had that surrounding her, and in that... she could have used that to her advantage. She could have become a powerful queen. Maybe she wouldn't have. Maybe she would have been the kind of woman who would have contented herself with raising Edward, with supervising his more children. I'm somewhat doubtful of that, given Henry's supposed sexual giving birth, impregnating people, for want of a better word. And it seemed to get worse as he got, who knows, they might have had more children. That would have only increased her position as a regent. What if she had survived Henry? She was quite a bit younger than him. I think it's very unlikely that Jane would have fallen because, she'd provided the heir. I think it would have been almost untouchable. And so it's very possible that she would have survived Henry. So it's interesting to think, what would her position have been in the regency of her son, Edward? She would have been right at the center. Her brother, Edward Seymour, ended up being the Lord Protector. She would have been right up there because people like to keep these things in the family. Boy. The difficulty is with thinking about which should be powerful. Thomas Cromwell's still there. And Thomas Cromwell's not a man who shares power. It's fall. And of course he fell because of the marriage to Anne of Cleves. Maybe he would have fallen even without that. Because obviously if Jane Seymour was the Queen, Anne of Cleves wouldn't have turned up. Maybe Cromwell would have fallen for some other reason. You can only rise so high and stay there for so long. But if Cromwell stayed around, you could possibly say that Jane wouldn't have had much power because it's quite difficult for a woman to gain power, and particularly if you have this all-powerful chief minister figure. It may have been that that she wouldn't have had it, but it's possible. But like I said, with the little that we know about Jane, and certainly about her personality, there's only snippets, and so it's really difficult to get an idea of the kind of woman she was.
So you talked about Catherine of Aragon and then the difference with how Anne of Cleves accepted kind of her lot. And it would have been really frightening for her, I would think, and also not knowing the language. How do you think she was able to negotiate this deal for herself? How was she able to be successful with that? Tell me a little bit about just how she went through the... kind of how she went through the motions of having that happen.
She was. I think it's also fair to say, though, that a lot of these things happened to her. She didn't have much of a say in what went on. She was sent away from court so that this coup against her could take place, that she could, the divorce could happen. She didn't really understand the culture. She didn't really know anyone. Her English was iffy. And so she didn't have a choice in how the divorce proceedings went down. She didn't have a powerful figure, she like Catherine of Aragon did. So if you're being uncharitable, you could say, well, she didn't really have any choice in how she handled it. It just happened. Sure. But she did play her hand well, and she played it well all the way through. Yes, it was she did the sensible thing, possibly one could argue the obvious thing. Mm-hmm. Catherine did the obvious thing, though, and look what happened. She recognized the situation, and she, like I said, she took the deal when the going was good. She could have fought it. She could have said, no, I'm from a good family. Don't deserve to be treated this way. She could have easily done that and tried to sort of win Henry back in that sense. And that wouldn't have gone well. And we sort of saw with Catherine of Aragon, the deals that she was being offered got steadily worse over time as Henry got more and more angry, more and more frustrated. And that likely would have happened with Anne of Cleves as well. She wasn't going to win this. There's no situation in which Anne of Cleves and Henry suddenly made up and they lived happily ever after. You know, she was going to be ditched. And so she recognized that situation. But I think the way that she really did well in the later periods, she didn't force herself on the court. She didn't try and throw her weight around. She clearly thought Elfbe the rightful queen throughout the rest of her life, or at least certainly the rest of Henry's life. She didn't think that what happened was right, but she also knew that she wasn't going to get there by being an obstinate woman like Catherine did. She never gave up on trying to become queen again. Catherine Howard fell, she put up a big fight to try and become queen again, and by all accounts she was absent. Catherine Parr became queen. When Catherine Parr was in a bit of trouble towards the end of her time as queen, when it looked like she might well even be executed, there were sort of rumours flying around that maybe Anne of Cleves could take over again. So even there were the other two wives, there was a sort of spectre of Anne of Cleves as this, you know, powerful, sort of wealthy dowager, the king's sister, all being there. And she was a figure in the kingdom right the way through. The way she negotiated it is by having the awareness of knowing what her position was, the weakness of her position, but also that there was still a significant figure, still maintain her dignity. And he played her cards right.
And then thinking about stereotypes, Catherine Howard has so many stereotypes with her. There's like the abused girl, there's the party girl. Kind of what do you think is the truth behind that? And tell us who the real woman was behind all of those stereotypes.
There's another thing I found out when studying Catherine Howard. There is a real huge problem when you're trying to study her. And that's that we don't know when she was born. Now, that's not enormously unusual for women in the Middle Ages and in the early modern period, particularly ones that she came from a powerful family, but she came from kind of the unfashionable end. So, but what's unusual about Catherine is there's such a wide variance in when she was born, and given so much of what happened to her happened when she was very young, and obviously it's very difficult to know. There's, like I say, I'm not sure I mentioned, there's a 7-year variance. And so when you study her, it's difficult to know when you talk about these men coming into her dormitory, you know, like I was talking about in this weird boarding school thing. It's all rather fun and exciting and interesting to think about if it's happening to a woman or girl between about the age 13, 14, 15, 16, because at that time that was considered of age, that, you know, you can get married then, children then. So that is another end of the spectrum. This is happening to someone who's 10, 11 years old. And so it's quite fashionable amongst a lot to play the abuse narrative with Catherine Howard. She's in a lot of narrative now, she's no longer the party girl. She's this abused woman, or girl even, who right from the beginning was taken advantage of by, did not have her best interests at heart, and taught her all the wrong lessons. Annoyingly, I don't have the book anymore, which sort of persuaded me vaguely of how old she was. The date that I found most plausible of her birth was about 1522, 1523. This means that when she met the man number one, man called Henry Mannix, who was a music teacher, she was about 13, 14, and he was about 19. So I think the abuse narrative isn't quite right. Particularly, as I say, I don't like denying people their agency. And from everything that we can tell with Catherine, she was in control of these relationships. All these men seem utterly, all the men in her life seem utterly besotted by her. She seems this incredibly vivacious, lively girl and woman. So I don't play into the abuse narrative. The party girl narrative I do buy into a little bit. But I think that's really the fault of her upbringing. She was incredibly let down by every single person in her life who had some sort of position of authority over, who had some sort of parental idea. Her father was, like I said, an absolute waste of space. He was terrible. He kept getting decent marriages and spending all the money. He was a gambler. He was always in debt. He basically abandoned the family to get jobs on the continent to try and earn some money. So Catherine was put in this finishing school, boarding school, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. I think it was her grandmother, Agnes Howard, who was in charge. And her job was to mold these girls, these young women, into courtly and stately and dignified and morally upright women. We see this with a lot of the other queens. You seem to have this figure in her life. Usually it's a mother or maybe some other guardian who imbues them with the sense of how to carry yourself, how you acted in when you were a grown up, when you were at court. Catherine Howard learned none of these lessons. The supervision was incredibly lax, if anything. Agnes Howard was told many, many times about what was going on. It was happening under her nose, everyone knew, and yet she made only cursory attempts to try and do anything about it. When Catherine Howard finally left there, having had already had sex for the first time, we're not married, very bad idea in the Middle Ages, and she'd had these flings. She'd learned all the wrong lessons about how you could act, and because she'd never been taught anything different. Then she was sort of thrown into court, a lot of people seem to be throwing her at Henry to try and grow the position of the Howard clan at court. None of them did any due diligence. You would have thought that if you're trying to raise your position at court, you would perhaps ask a few questions about how things have been going at home. Anyone could have told her that she was completely ill-suited to be a queen, but they just saw dollar signs, they saw money and influence they could have if they could get this Howard to marry Henry. And again, she was completely let down by them as well. And her fall was entirely of her own doing, at least superficially, because she made it to carry on these affairs. She brought into her household lots of women who were around her when she was growing up at Chesham Hall and at Lambeth Palace. And she's surrounded by them. There's a suggestion that may have been a bit of blackmail, but she certainly didn't help us by keeping the ghosts in her past, the skeletons in her closet, right there for anyone to see. And in the Tudor court, really backbiting place, people were going to find out. This was not going to be a secret that was going to be held. And she was still flirting around with people. So I love her because she is just completely different to everyone else. She's this breath of fresh air, but she was a breath of fresh air in the worst possible way.
And so then such a switch to Catherine Parr, who was a writer, a published writer, who was a reformer. I'd love to know more about her as a woman and particularly her writing, and then also a little bit about kind of the threats that she fell under as a reformer and how she was able to navigate through that successfully.
Queen of England, to publish under her own name. She published at least three books. The first one was a translation. It wasn't actually published under her name. The first one that she did publish under her own name is a book called Prayers and Meditations. And this was a collection of translated texts. It's about 65 pages long, and it's meant for private devotion. And this is very much part of her own brand of Protestantism. She was, it was in English, so this is very important in that sense. But the most famous one, the most important thing that she published, Lamentations of the Sinner. It was written about was finished writing in about 1546. So she'd been queen for after Henry's death, because it was very controversial. It's quite radical. It's possibly the most radical text ever written by an English woman up to that point. One of the most radical things ever written by any woman in up to that point in sort of medieval early Europe. Lamentations, unlike the other two things with the translations, is a sort of a conversion narrative. She talks about what the problems in the Catholic Church. She's very, very rude about the establishment of the church. She calls them foul gluttons, adulterers, fornicators. You know, the language, the really, it's a really extreme anti-Catholic language there. She espouses, and I already said I don't like the word feminism, but I guess a kind of form of proto-feminism, in the sense that using the Bible and the example of Jesus Christ as an example, she identifies the virtues that the Christ child is seen as having of being humble, meek, and innocent. And she says, well, these are the same virtues that an obedient Christian wife is supposed to have. So she is not making men and women the same, but she is raising them onto the same plane, at least. And she thinks they should be viewed with a degree of equality. They shouldn't have the same powers. She wasn't saying that men and women should be in the sense of what they did, but they should be morally at least equal and should be listened to equally. Possibly the reason why she didn't publish it under until Henry died is she attacks kings in general, but the attacks she makes could very easily be made against Henry. She criticizes princes as being warriors who didn't fight for the right reasons. They fought for selfish reasons, for their own reasons. They fought power, whereas Jesus Christ fought for the meek, fought for the humble, fought for the glory of God. She sort of compares that to the biblical example of David. And so what she's essentially thinking, I think, is that the wars that the men, the powerful, and the fighting are these sort of insignificant, like children playing, other than when compared to the real fights that were happening and that needed to be fought and that should be. And she doesn't mention Henry by name. She doesn't make any particular over allusion to Henry, but Henry was very, very fond of war. He was very, very fond of trying to restore England and to its position of being a dominant power in Europe, Henry V. And Catherine, essentially in this, is saying, you are a child, stop being so selfish. To then move on a bit to the plot against her. As I said, Catherine is the first queen. The religious situation in England in the late mid-1540s is this very weird sort of stalemate. When you have these conservative forces like the Duke of Norfolk, like Stephen Gardiner, you have these quite extreme Protestant figures like Catherine Parr and Thomas Cranmer, the Archbishop of Canterbury. And then you have Henry in the middle, who is this person who sees, the only person who seems quite content and happy with how things are. He was only ever really interested in religious reform, so as far as it improved his own, a true believer. He certainly wasn't a Protestant. And so this plot was a plot made, organized. He got to Thomas Cranmer, and not that hadn't worked out. And so Catherine was like the second in the rung, which is just how powerful Catherine was. You know, she was seen as the second most important religious reformist figure in the kingdom after the Archbishop of Canterbury.
Wow.
What's interesting about this plot, though, and this happened the same with Thomas Cranmer, is that Henry was very, very fond of playing people off against each other to try and maintain the middle. Mm-hmm. And so he, with Catherine, Catherine liked to go in, it was ill at the time, and Catherine liked to go into his bedchamber and nag him about you know, how he wasn't being reformist enough, trying to persuade him to be more Protestant, using, from what we can tell, quite aggressive, not to say aggressive, very assertive, I would say, language and argument. She wasn't being meek here, she was being very assertive. Stephen Gardiner, the Bishop of Winchester, very conservative figure, comes along and essentially tells Henry, you know, are you going to stand for that? Mm. And Henry sort of chews her out over it and basically tells the conservative forces, she's gone, I'm going to get rid of her. But then Henry guarantees that Catherine advances of this, for complicated reasons. And so Catherine has the opportunity to save herself if she wanted to, or if she was willing to role, be a bit more of the meek, humble woman that she seems to talk about a lot in Lamentations of a Sinner. And she does do that. As soon as she felt that Henry is meaning to have her arrested, after a, what we can tell from the sources, a panic attack, she makes sure she hides all of the kind of Protestant books she has, all the ones that could be considered problematic. She sort of throws herself at her husband's feet and tells terms as how much of a submissive wife she wants to be. She gives excuses as to her behavior. She talks about how she only wants to learn from the great Henry VIII about what a true Christian should be in this time. You know, she didn't believe in any of this. She didn't have any choice, but she did what had to be done. She was kind of set up for this by Henry. Thomas Cranmer, same thing happened to Thomas Cranmer a little bit before. And so again, the way for her was set out for her, but she played her cards right. She played the position. She had the awareness to make sure that she did everything right. And there's a very amusing story of Henry and Catherine walking through a garden and the conservatives turning up to arrest that, you know, Henry had given her that position, that permission and that order. And he absolutely yells them, tells them to go home. And then Catherine's just sort of pretty and very smug. So I think, yeah, I mean, again, she's a bit like Anne of Cleves in the sense that the way it was made for her, she was, the way to salvation wasn't a particularly circuitous one. It was one that was, there was a thing she had to do. She had to give in. She had to be submissive. Catherine Parr was not a submissive woman by trait. It wasn't a very easy thing for him. The things that she said to Henry to save her own life, the things that she did not believe in. But again, she knew what to do. She did it.
And then my kind of final question is about their relationships with Mary, particularly because she would have been an adult for most of these queens. So maybe just a little bit on the children, but particularly kind of what their relationships would have been like with Henry's adult daughter with Mary.
Mary, a lot of the wives seem to have quite a positive view of Mary. They seem to have found her a very impressive person. Start off with Jane Seymour. We know that the two were friendly. They got on. What we can, I think, say that these were two people who had a lot of pressures coming in. The Tudor court is an incredibly French, stabby, you know, backstabby sort of place. And I think they got on essentially because they didn't have real interest between them in whether they got on or whether they were enemies. And so they kind of just got on because they could be themselves around. Wasn't using Mary and Mary wasn't using Jane. And we know that they got on quite well because Eustace Chapuis, the imperial ambassador, who was Charles V, the emperor, was Mary's cousin. So always very keen to tell Charles who is on their side and who's against them. And he has some fairly nice things to say about Jane once she becomes queen. With Anne of Cleves, religion, I don't think, was a hugely important thing here. They seem to have treated each other with respect. They were both kind of, they've gone through a very similar thing with, when it came to Henry. Mary was much, you know, she was the symbol of the failed marriage. She was an obstinate, stubborn woman. And, you know, she made no bounds about her disapproval of everything that was going on. And of course, had been sort of unceremoniously chucked away from the throne and managed to sort of maintain the position, but she was still, it was still a very humiliating thing that happened to her, being married and then dumped, and the language used, she was, you know, talking about how, you know, ugly she was. Henry questioned her virginity.
Right.
He, you know, some really nasty things. And Mary at that time was also forced to sign a settlement that acknowledged her ambassador, that acknowledged that her mother's marriage wasn't legal. You know, the very things that Catherine of Mary was forced to deny it, to sign their way, to save her own skin. And so I think the two found themselves sort of a spirit. Neither of them were a whole lot. So I think you can't sort of see them as sort of always, you know, hanging about in the corner gossiping or whatever. You know, they wouldn't have seen each other all that often, but they seemed to get on and enjoy each other's company. Anne Cleves was present when Mary came to the throne. Things got a little bit difficult between them towards the end, but they seemed close, or at least friends, I mean, right through past Henry's death, through Edward's reign, and then to the beginning of Mary's. With Catherine Howard, it's always a problem when your father marries someone who's younger than you. Not that I have any experience of this, but I can only imagine it's a really weird thing to happen. So she certainly couldn't be a mother figure to Mary. Mary seems to have held Catherine in a great degree of contempt. She, you know, Mary was a very dignified woman. She was the daughter of Catherine of Aragon, this incredibly important woman and, you know, incredibly stately woman. She was the granddaughter of Isabella of Castile and of Ferdinand of Aragon, you know, powerful, powerful people. And of course, she was the king's daughter. Who is this Catherine Howard? You know, who the hell is she, and what hell does she have to say that's important? Catherine Howard actually seems to have taken a bit more of an interest in Elizabeth. Elizabeth starts getting a bit older. And I think you can see that in the sense of, you know, Elizabeth was a Howard in the sense that she was Anne Boleyn's daughter, and Boleyn was the daughter of a Howard, and sort of part of that clan. And so, or at least people around thought that you could create, you know, this Howard centre of gravity with Elizabeth in it as well. Catherine Parr is was an incredibly good stepmother. She seems to have really thrived in this role. It began with her second marriage. She inherited from her second husband, who was a widower as well, two children. She took a particular interest in her daughter, whose name escapes me. I want to say she was called Margaret, but I might be wrong on that. Don't quote me on that. She was very interested in her spiritual education, and she turned her into this reformist figure because her second husband was not in any way interested in reform. Catherine was, and she essentially turned his daughter into a Protestant. So she had that experience when she married Henry. She was about the same age as Mary, she wasn't really a mother figure to Mary, but she was a staunch ally of Mary and a promoter of her interests. Mm. And she sort of took advantage of the situation that occurred. Henry knew that his reign was coming to an end. He wasn't going to have any more children. So I think he was perhaps more inclined to restore Mary and Elizabeth's succession just to secure it. But it may not have happened without Catherine Parr being an advocate for them, sort of cajoling and promoting them, involving them in courtly activities. It's arguable but possible to say that you don't get Mary Tudor and Elizabeth without Catherine Parr. I wouldn't stake my house on it, but I think it's quite possible that you'd miss all of it out, that they just get ignored, and we have a very fractious succession when Edward died. Catherine was very involved with Edward. I know your question was about Mary, but I'd like to expand it a little bit to talk about Edward. She wrote a lot to Edward and to Elizabeth as well, and to Mary, but Edward, there's an awful lot of correspondence, and he asks her for advice. He's a mother figure. Obviously, he never knew his mother. She died when he was only a few days old, and none of the other queens had really shown much of an interest in him. She took an interest in his education. There's a story of when a French ambassador comes to court and Edward is supposed to to go with him from where he lands to the palace. And there's an adorable letter where Edward is essentially asking him, you know, what do I do? How do I do this? She talks about what language do I speak to him? You know, I need to brush up on my Latin to talk Latin to him. It's really cute. With the fly in the ointment with as far as Henry's children is concerned is Elizabeth. She did all those things I've been talking about when Henry was alive. She took an interest in the education. She tried her best to make sure that she was brought up in what she thought was the best way, i.e. the Protestant way. But when Henry died, Elizabeth was essentially placed into Catherine's care, her and her new husband, Thomas Seymour, and along with Jane Grey. And there are some quite famous and quite disturbing stories of what happened when Elizabeth was in Catherine's care, because her husband, Thomas, engaged in some incredibly inappropriate activity in terms of essentially grooming Elizabeth. Maybe not as a as a future wife, but certainly as is someone who is dependent on him. He used to sort of touch her in inappropriate places. He would sort of get into bed with her, all sorts of horrible stuff. And Catherine knew about this, and she even participated in some of it. It's a different time. Some of the evidence we have is a little bit old, so it's difficult to know exactly what was going on. But I think it's difficult to give Catherine Parr the complete motherly tick, because she does have this problem at the end, because I think she was blinded by her love for her husband, and he wasn't a very appropriate person, a very nice person. But she certainly, Catherine Parr had more importance in the bringing up of Henry's children than anyone else. Certainly more than their respective parents did. Certainly once their respective parents are taken out of the equation, because obviously with Mary Tudor, her mother was the most important figure, but she lived with her mother alive for a very long time.
And then finally, before we let you go, how can people find out more about you? How can they support you? Do you have any plugs for anything? Tell us more about where we can find out more about you and about the show and about how we can support you.
I did the Queens of England podcast just over 2 years ago now. Started with Matilda of Flanders, the wife of William the Conqueror, and I've been taking each one in turn all the way through. Last week, I wrapped the last of Henry's wives. The last episode on that does an awful lot with the stuff I was just talking about with Catherine Parr. Today, I'm the first in a sort of series of supplementals, because I'm not going to be covering, even though it's called the Queens of England, I'm not going to be covering Mary and Elizabeth, because they ruled and I'm more interested in the sorts. But I'm going to be talking about Philip of Spain, Mary Tudor's husband. So that's probably the next episode that I'll pop up in your feeds if you did want to subscribe. I'm going to be going right through to the end of the Stuarts. So there's lots still to come. You can find the podcast anywhere you normally find podcasts. I hope it's everywhere at least. You can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, anything. Just type in Queens of England podcast and you'll find it. I'm on all the usual social medias as well. Just type those in. The website is queensofenglandpodcast.com, where you can find all the episodes and various other things as well. If you did want to support me, if I have any of my listeners out there who aren't supporting me at the moment, you can go to patreon.com/queensofenglandpodcast. I'm very lucky to have a small number, quite a large number of very generous benefactors, and it's really, really useful in getting all the best equipment, in getting lots of all the right books, and just being able to continue this project and devote as much time as I can.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.